This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
So we're counting down the top 24 most important Civil War battles that were fought in Virginia, right?
That's right.
There you go. So we've done First Manassas.
First Manassas, the Monitor versus the Virginia.
Which is not the Merrimack. It was named the Virginia, actually, right?
That's right. That's right. The USS naval vessel that the Virginia was built from was the USS Merrimack.
Got it.
So
okay.
That's where the confusion comes from. Then number three was Fort Darling or Drury's Bluff. It goes by two names. And then number four was Seven Pines, Fair Oaks. And those are the two that we did last time.
All right, so we are on number five,
which is
what? It also has two names, right?
Well, no, actually, number five is two battles, but they're two battles. They're only 2 days apart. They're in the same campaign. They're only a day apart, and they're in the same campaign, so people usually talk about them together, and that's Cross Keys and Port Republic. And what they are the capstone battles of Jackson's 1862 Shenandoah Valley campaign. Of all the different campaigns in Virginia during the Civil War, you could probably say that this is the most studied because it's the most amazing. He just did an amazing job with only about 17,000 men. And these are the last two battles. So I chose these because they ended up the campaign. It would be kind of difficult to pick just one that was the most important out of all of the battles that he fought during this campaign.
We're talking with Rick Britton online at rickbritton.com. So take us back in time now to this campaign and why these two battles, just 2 days apart, are so significant and they make your list.
Well, they're important because the campaign is one of the most studied and the most admired military campaigns in all of the Civil War. Jackson, after Manassas, was sent out to the Shenandoah Valley and was put in charge of the Valley District. So his command, his charge was to protect Virginia's left flank, so to speak, the Shenandoah Valley. And he started off with only about 10,000 men. And then federal forces advanced into the valley out of Maryland, you know, through Harper's Ferry and down to Winchester. Under General Nathaniel Banks, he was a Massachusetts Politico general. I'm not one of my favorite generals. And then there was also generals out in what's today West Virginia that started to advance to the east. And so all of a sudden, just as McClellan is coming up the peninsula against the Confederate capital at Richmond, all of a sudden Virginia's left flank is threatened. And so it looked initially really bad. And what the concern was in Richmond was, number one, that 50,000-man force that was advancing south from Washington that was advancing and eventually got to Fredericksburg. So they didn't want that force to communicate and to join with McClellan's force of over 100,000 coming up the peninsula. But they also didn't want any of these forces to be sent to reinforce those or to go to Washington, D.C. So Jackson's initial charge was to hold all of these federal forces in the Shenandoah Valley. And we're talking about if you add the force at Fredericksburg and all of the forces in the Shenandoah Valley, upwards of 80,000 men, and initially only has 10,000.
We're talking with Rick Britton. So, Rick, when is this again? Is this is shortly after First Manassas?
No, this battle takes place just as the Peninsula Campaign is starting up. So this is June 8th and 9th, 1862. In the late spring of 1862.
So this is over a year into the Civil War.
Yeah, this is over a year into the fighting. And Jackson was sent out there, and for a while it was really quiet. But you know what happens in the Civil War is as the spring hits, that's when the campaigns really get underway. There are very few, almost no battles in the wintertime. But we're going to get to one that happened later. Fredericksburg was fought in the dead of winter. But, you know, mostly the army shut down in the wintertime.
Yeah.
So Jackson was reinforced. Richmond sent him another division. So he gets up to around 16 or 17,000 men. And in the process of a number of lightning moves, secretive moves, pulled punches, he manages to not only keep all of these forces in the Shenandoah Valley, but make Washington, D.C., the Lincoln administration, afraid that there's a huge Confederate force in the valley and that Washington is actually threatened. So he goes way beyond his charge, and they actually sent reinforcements to the Shenandoah Valley. So aside from just holding those forces out there and making sure that McClellan wasn't reinforced, he made sure that some of the reinforcements that were going to be sent to McClellan were sent out there. So he went way beyond what his duty was, and in the process won a number of little battles, and these are the final two. And Cross Keys and Port Republic are just east of Harrisonburg. If you think of the Massanutten mountain range, which runs right up the middle of the Shenandoah Valley for 50 miles, the southern face of the Massanutten Range looks down on both of these battlefields.
We're talking with Rick Britton online at rickbritton.com, taking us back to the summer of 1862, Cross Keys and Port Republic. So the Federals are advancing now down the valley, right?
Right. They're advancing actually up the Shenandoah Valley. They're advancing southwest up the Shenandoah Valley, and there's a force in the main valley under Fremont, and there's a force in the Luray Valley under Shields, and they're both advancing against Jackson. He places himself strategically so that he could attack either one as they popped out of their respective valleys, if you follow me. And it was just perfect positioning. So he takes on Fremont first, and Fremont was not known for his aggressiveness ever, so he was able to stop Fremont and actually push Fremont back at the Battle of Cross Keys on June 8, 1862, and then that allowed him to concentrate against the other force coming against him under under General Shields. And after a very heated battle at Port Republic on June 9th, he was able to throw that force back. So he defeated pretty much both of these forces. He would have been outnumbered if they had joined forces, but he was able to fight them independently, and this is what you want to do. You want to concentrate your force against smaller forces of the enemy before they can concentrate. That pretty much is the story of the whole Shenandoah Valley campaign. Just brilliant maneuvering, a lot of secretive moves, and a lot of really lightning-fast marches, marches that nobody thought were possible at the time he was able to do with his small force.
So, Rick, the Confederates then in the valley, at least during the Civil War, were fighting arguably leaner. They weren't as well manned. They weren't as well supplied. But they were fighting much smarter than the. The Confederates were fighting much smarter than the Federals. Is that right?
In this case, yes. Later on, and we're going to get to Early's campaign in 1864 and Sheridan facing him. So later on, that wasn't the case. But the Shenandoah Valley was just so important, and we're going to come back to it a couple of times in the course of our series of 24. The Shenandoah Valley is arguably more important to the Confederacy than it is to the Federals. It's important for two main reasons to the Confederates, to the administration in Richmond. Number one, it's the breadbasket of the Confederacy, so it's supplying all kinds of foodstuffs, wheat, other grains, beef cattle, to the armies. But also, if you know the geography of Virginia, it doesn't run straight north and south. It runs from the southwest to the northeast. So a Confederate army moving down the Shenandoah Valley, and you go down when you go to the northeast, moving down the Shenandoah Valley is getting closer and closer to the enemy capital. And that's what made it a really valuable invasion route for Confederate forces, and it was used a number of times, at least three I can think of off the top of my head.
Well, and it also explains why the Union troops were so eager to get control of it.
Of course, but conversely, exactly right, but conversely, it's not as good an invasion route for Federal forces, because as they go up the Shenandoah Valley to the southwest, they're getting further and further away from the Confederate capital.
Which is why you have to turn at Waynesboro and cut across through Charlottesville.
Exactly, exactly. Or go down to Roanoke and take a left turn and come across to Lynchburg.
We're talking with Rick Britton, local author, historian, and cartographer, online at rickbritton.com. So that's Cross Keys and Port Republic, right?
That's Cross Keys and Port Republic. And because of those victories, you could argue that whole campaign was so stunning, was so brilliant, that virtually all of Jackson's force was able to come back out of the valley and reinforce Robert E. Lee at Richmond, over 70 miles away. Right, because all of those, and the administration, the Lincoln administration, is still trying to figure out where did they go. We thought there was a huge force, and time again, from the Confederate point of view, audacity and aggressiveness gave the impression to the enemy of overwhelming numbers when it wasn't. It was audacity born of desperation.
So were the Confederate soldiers more aggressive in this war, you think?
I don't know if man for man the Confederate soldiers were more aggressive, but in the early stages of the war, you could argue successfully, I believe, that Confederate officers, generals, were more aggressive, yes.
They were charging more.
And some people said, and we're going to get to huge charges in just a moment, and there were people who said, you know, that Robert E. Lee's middle name could be audacity.
We're talking with Rick Britton. Let's go on to number six, which is Gaines's Mill.
Yeah, Gaines's Mill. So now we're back, now we're back just outside of Richmond, and McClellan has positioned his force facing Richmond, and he made the mistake of earlier, if you remember, at the Battle of Seven Pines or Fair Oaks, he made the mistake of leaving a smaller portion of his force on the Richmond side of the Chickahominy River. So he was given the high sign, of course, by that attack and by that battle, that they were willing to counterattack out of Richmond. So he reinforced that body of his army and left a smaller portion of his army on the northern side of the Chickahominy, away from Richmond. So once Robert E. Lee took command and renamed his army the Army of Northern Virginia, which of course gave everybody the right idea of what his intentions were. He wanted to get back to fighting in Northern Virginia as soon as possible. Robert E. Lee did something that was very audacious. He left a small portion of his force facing the enemy directly in front of Richmond, and then took the majority of his forces on the other side of the Chickahominy, which is just north of Richmond and flowing west to east in that portion of Virginia. He put them on the other side, the same side as that smaller portion of McClellan's force, and then attacked east down the Chickahominy. Now, there were a series of battles. Now we're in the 7 days battles, and Gaines's Mill is actually the third battle of the 7 days, but I didn't include the others because they're not as big. This is the first large battle where the Army of Northern Virginia faced the Army of the Potomac under the command of Robert E. Lee. This is the first one. And I would argue that this is where everybody could see that Robert E. Lee was willing to throw attack after attack at the enemy, that he was willing to be very, very aggressive, and especially this close to Richmond, to get the enemy back away from the capital of the Confederacy. At Gaines's Mill, sits atop a little hill, but it has a swamp, Bosun Swamp, that curves around it that formed almost a perfect moat, a perfect defensive position for the Federals, who were defending, in this case, under Porter, Fitzjohn Porter. And they had their men arrayed in tiers with lots of artillery, great defensive positions. And in this battle, Robert E. Lee threw attack after attack against these positions. And through most of the day, these attacks were unsuccessful. Jackson was supposed to show up against the enemy right flank and turn the enemy right flank, and they waited and they waited, and it took Jackson longer than expected to get up there. And the local boys from this area, the 19th Virginia, in Pickett's brigade at this time — Pickett was a brigadier just commanding a brigade of 5 regiments, they were in an attack and suffered heavy casualties. And it wasn't until finally they brought up the Texas Brigade as the sun was going down, and the Texas Brigade, along with Pickett's brigade, again made a what had earlier been a disastrous attack over the same ground, but they were able to overrun the first Federal works. And then an interesting thing happened here that happened in several other battles. If you have your defensive positions arrayed one behind another too close, as the men retreat from one, they mask the fire of their friends from the other. So because the Texas Brigade and Pickett's Brigade, they were able to overrun the first Federal position, as the Federals who survived ran back to the second position, their friends couldn't fire. And so in the darkness, they were able to overrun all of the federal lines, and so they had to retreat. The Federals retreated down the Chickahominy and then back to join the rest of the forces to the south of the Chickahominy eventually. So a lot of disastrous Confederate attacks, a lot horrendous losses, the first really major battle under General Robert E. Lee, but nonetheless, he tossed the enemy back from the outskirts of Richmond.
Rick Britton, local author, historian, cartographer. You can learn more online at rickbritton.com. We continue to count down the top 24 most important Civil War battles that were fought here in Virginia. Rick, when we talk next week, we'll pick up with number 7, Malvern Hill.
That's right.
And then 2nd Manassas, and then a really big one, Fredericksburg.
On to Fredericksburg, right.
Looking forward to that. Rick, thank you so much, buddy. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.